government. Citizens, for example. Suppose that, every 12 years, we lose our perks and privileges of office. We reapply, submit our records as citizens, get examined, tested, checked out for competency, and pay our fees. If we pass, we get a new citizen's license, stamped with big red letters saying, use it or lose it. If we flunk, we'll be given mercy and sent back for retraining in history and law and civic responsibility. We'll actually be allowed 2 more chances to pass muster. However, recall our latest social standard. 3 strikes, you're out. A little more lighthearted now. This is about Crayolas. Good friends finally put their resources together and made themselves a kid, a son. Me, I'm the godfather in the deal, and I take my job seriously. So far, I've introduced the kid to the good things in life, chocolate, beer, cigars, Beethoven, and dirty jokes. I don't think the kid cares much for Beethoven, actually, but he's only 1.5 years old, which is why beer, cigars, and dirty jokes don't cut much ice with him either. But yes, on chocolate. I haven't told him about sex yet, but, well, he seems to have some ideas of his own already. I won't go into details here, but if you've ever had a little kid or have ever been a little kid, then you know what I mean. We seem to figure out right away where certain parts are. Anyhow, I also introduced him to crayons. Bought the Crayola beginner set, the short, fat, thick ones with training wheels. Every few weeks I would put one in his hand and show him how to make a mark with it. Mostly he just held it and stared at me. Then we went through the orifice stuffing phase, where the Crayola went in his mouth and ears and nose, and finally, last week, I held his hand and made a big red mark with the Crayola on a sheet of newsprint, and wham, he got the picture. A light bulb went off in a new room in his head, yes, and he did it again on his own, and again, and again. Now, reports his mother with a mixture of pleasure and pain, there is no stopping him from making his mark on the walls of his existence wherever and whenever he feels like it. Crayolas plus imagination, the ability to create images. These make for happiness if you are a kid. Amazing things, Crayolas. Some petroleum-based wax, some dye, a little binder, not much to them. Until you add the imagination. The Benny Company in Pennsylvania makes about 2 billion of these oleaginous sticks of pleasure every year and exports them to every country in the United Nations. Crayolas are one of the few things the human race has in common. That green and yellow box hasn't changed since 1937, the year I was born. In fact, the only change has been to rename the flesh color peach. That's a sign of progress, I suppose. Well, when I bought my godson his trainer set, I indulged myself. Bought my very own set of 64 in the big 4-section box with the sharpener built right in. I never had my own set like this before. Seems like I was always too young for the good set or too old for the good set to have one. While I was at it, I bought several sets. I got one for the kid's mother and the father, and explained to them it was theirs, not his. Fine gift. What I notice is that every adult or child I give a new set of Crayolas to goes a little funny. The kids smile, get a glazed look on their faces, pour the crayons out, and just look at them for a while. And then they go to work on the nearest flat surface and will draw anything you ask. Just name it. The adults always get the most wonderful kind of sheepish smile on their faces, a mixture of delight and nostalgia and silliness, and they immediately start telling you about all their experiences with Crayolas, their first box, using every color, breaking them, trying to get them in the box in order again, trying to use them in a bundle, putting them on hot things to see them melt, shaving them onto waxed paper and ironing them into stained glass windows, eating them, and so on and so on. If you want an interesting adult party sometime, combine cocktails and a fresh box of Crayolas for everybody. Funny. When you think about it, for sheer bulk, there's more art done with Crayolas than with anything else. There must be billions of sheets of paper in every country in the world, in billions of boxes and closets and attics and cupboards, covered with billions of pictures in crayon. The imagination of the human race poured out like a river in low and high places. Even presidents and prime ministers and generals all used Crayola sometime in their lives. Maybe we should develop a Crayola bomb as our next secret weapon, a happiness weapon, a beauty bomb. And every time a crisis developed, we would launch one of them first before we tried anything else. The bombs would explode high in the air, explode softly, and send thousands, millions of little parachutes into the air, floating down to earth, boxes of Crayolas. And we wouldn't go cheap, either. Not little boxes of 8, boxes of 64, with the sharpener built right in, with silver and gold and copper, magenta and peach and lime, amber and all the rest. And people would smile and get a little funny look on their faces, and maybe cover the world with imagination instead of death. A child who touched one of these bombs wouldn't have his hand blown off. I know, that sounds truly absurd, doesn't it? A bit dumb, crazy, silly, weird, naive. Crayon bomb. Let me be clear about this. When I consider the horrible things we quite willingly developed at horrifying expense to quite willingly drop out of the sky, and when I think about what those horrible things will do, those weapons, well, I'm not confused about what's weird and crazy and absurd, and I'm not confused about the lack of or the need for imagination in low or high places. We could do better. We must do better. There are far, far worse things to drop on people than Crayolas. These next tales are about a real season as well as a season of my mind. Midwinter. From about, oh, say, Thanksgiving to Valentine's Day. Midwinter has a lot of stress in it. Darkness, cold, family tension, hope, despair, religious beliefs wrapped in the confusion of social obligation and economic necessity, and Christmas just happens to come in the middle of all this. Sometimes, Christmas seems more like Halloween to me, with all the ghosts and goblins that appear out of season. The contradictions of midwinter drive me crazy. Some years I have wanted to hide in a hole, while in other years I wanted to organize extravaganzas, and some years I wanted to do both at the same time. One cannot live and be free of contradictions, and maybe I'll get used to that someday. Several years ago, I gave away my substantial collection of Christmas decorations, including many boxes of wind-up toys and a fine selection of wooden things made in Bavaria and Austria, the kind that go round and round driven by the heat from candles. An era was over. Pass the stuff on to the next generation. No fuss or muss in my house for Christmas. My kids stored those boxes in their basements and attics, and there they sat. This year, I missed my Christmas stuff. So I took it all back, put it all up, had a fine time. Next year, well, who knows? The first of these midwinter essays is called The Great Heathen. Jesus was a Jew. This is my father's voice. He's acting as a theological matador to my mother while she charged around the arena of our living room getting ready for the Christmas competition. Jesus was a Jew, dear. He wasn't a Christian, dear. And he wasn't born on December the 25th, dear. Jesus is dead, dear, and he isn't coming back, dear, so calm down and shut up, dear. My mother would retreat from the room crying. My father would go back to reading his newspaper in peace, which is all he wanted in the first place. Peace on earth beginning in our living room this evening. He once asked me, "Son, do you know why God didn't have Jesus get married?" "No, sir, why?" because having him crucified once was enough. My father was a born once, and once is enough, heathen. My mother was a born again and again and again supplicant of the Southern Baptist Church. There was a brick wall between them on this subject of religion, built and buttressed with bitterness over the years. Every December, I heard my father exclaim, "Jesus was a Jew, dear," and lay out his theological landmines. My mother would sob, "You're going to burn in hell," and flee the room, and that's how I knew Christmas was coming. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ding-ding-ding-ding. In the late afternoon of a windy, cold December day, in front of the Woolworth's five-and-dime store in Waco, Texas, a middle-aged man in suit, tie, and overcoat, Stetson hat, stands by a red steel tripod from which hangs a black iron soup kettle. An 8-year-old kid, bundled up against the coal, stands beside the man. The kid is working up a little rhythm with a small brass bell, ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding. This is the first year the kid has been allowed to ring the bell. Warned by the man not to do anything silly, the kid is trying to mix joy with the necessary reverence required of one who has been entrusted with a serious job. Ding-a-ling, ding-ding, ding-a-ling, ding-ding. I am that kid. The man is my father. And for a couple of hours, we are the Salvation Army. Remember, my father was not a Christian. At least, not by the standards of the Salvation Army, the Southern Baptist Church, or my mother. He was a heathen in their eyes, and proud of it. So it was puzzling to me that the great heathen would work for the Salvation Army, year after year, as long as he lived. I never asked why. He never explained. But every year, he was there and took me with him. Now I know the explanation lay in something he often said to me. "It doesn't matter what you say you believe, son. It only matters what you really do." After my father died, his sister told me that their family home had burned down when they were children, leaving them destitute. The Salvation Army came to the rescue. My aunt said their family was so humiliated about their poverty and plight that they never talked about it. If it had not been for the Salvation Army, those Christians, the family could not have stayed together. The Salvos practiced what they preached. And now I understand why my father and I were there at the kettle every year. It's simple. He told me, "We owe the pot. Do unto others." The great heathen said I didn't have to be a Christian or a Jew to do right. Ding, 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 dang, ding-a-ling, dong. Here's one of my all-time favorite Christmas stories. It's called Hong Duck. A Sunday afternoon it was, some days before Christmas in 1979. With rain, with wind, with cold winter's gloom, things to-do list was long and growing like a persistent mole, temper short, bio-index negative. Horoscope reading suggested caution, and the Sunday paper suggested dollars, death, destruction as the day's litany. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, fa-la-la-la-la. This holy hour of Lord's Day bliss was jarred by a pounding at the door. Now what? Deep sigh. Opening it, resigned to accept whatever bad news lies in wait, I am nonplussed. A rather small person in a cheap Santa Claus mask, carrying a large brown paper bag, out thrust at me. "Trick or treat," the Santa mask shouts. "What?" "Trick or treat," the Santa mask hoots again. Tongue-tied, I stare at this apparition. He shakes the bag at me, and dumbly I fish out of my wallet and find a dollar to drop into his bag. The mask is lifted, revealing an Asian kid with a $10 grin taking up most of his face. "Want to hear some caroling?" he asks in sing-song English. I know him now. He belongs to a family settled into the neighborhood by the Quakers last year. Vietnamese boat people, I believe. Refugees. He stopped by at Halloween with his sisters and brothers, and I filled their bags. Hong Duck is his name. He's maybe 8, 9. At Halloween, he looked like a wise man, with a bathrobe on and a dish towel around his head. You want to hear some caroling? I nod, envisioning an octet of urchin refugees hiding in the bushes, ready to join their leader in uplifted song. Sure, where's the choir? I'm it, says he. And he launched forth with an up-tempo chorus of jingle bells at full lung power, followed by an equally enthusiastic rendering of what I swear sounded like Hark the Hairy Angels Sing, and finally a soft-voiced, reverential singing of Silent Night. Head back, eyes closed, from the bottom of his heart, he poured out the last strains of Sleep in Heavenly Peace into the gathering night. Wet-eyed, dumbstruck by his unexpected performance, I pulled a $5 bill out of my wallet and dropped it into that paper bag. In return, he produced half a candy cane from his pocket and passed it solemnly to me. Flashing the $10 grin again, he turned and ran from the porch, shouting over his shoulder, God bless you and trick-or-treat, and he was gone. Who was that masked kid? Hong Duck, the one-man choir, delivering Christmas door to door. Now, I confess that I'm usually a little confused about Christmas. It has never made a lot of sense to me. Christmas is unreal. Ever since I got the word about Santa Claus, I've been a closet cynic at heart. Singing about riding in a one-horse open sleigh is ludicrous. I've never seen one, much less ridden in one. Never roasted chestnuts by an open fire, wouldn't know how to if I had one, and I hear they're no big deal anyway. Wandering wise men raise my suspicions, and shepherds who spend their lives hanging around with sheep are a little strange. Never seen a flying angel either, and my experience with virgins is really limited. The appearance of a newborn king doesn't interest me. I'd just as soon settle for some other president. Babies and reindeer stink. I've been around them both, and I know, and the little town of Bethlehem is a war zone. Singing about things I've never seen or done or wanted, dreaming of a white Christmas I've never known, Christmas isn't very real, and yet I'm too old to believe in it, and too young to give up on it, too cynical to get into it, and way too needy to stay out of it. Trick or treat. Right. After I shut the door came near hysteria, laughter, trick or treat, and tears, and that funny feeling you get when you know, once again, Christmas has gotcha. Right down the chimney of my midwinter hovel comes Saint Hong Duck. He is confused about the details, like me, but he is very clear about the spirit of the season. It's an excuse to let go and celebrate, to go door to door, to throw yourself into holiday with all you have, wherever you are. Where's the choir? I'm it, says he. Where's Christmas? I ask myself. I'm it, comes the echo. I'm it. Head back, eyes closed, voice raised in whatever song I can muster the courage to sing. God, it is said, once sent a child upon a starry night, that the world might know hope and joy. I'm not sure I quite believe that, or that I believe in all the baggage heaped upon that simple story during 2,000 years. But I am sure that I believe in Hong Duck, the one-man Christmas choir, shouting trick or treat, door to door at Christmas time. I don't know who or what sent him. But I know I am tricked through the whimsical mischief of fate into joining the choir that sings of joy and hope. Through a child, I have been treated to Christmas. This is about gifts and the brass rule. It is not my rule, necessarily. It came from a grumpy-looking man at a holiday office party, a man coming down with a full-blown case of Scrooge-itis. He had just unwrapped his dinky little present from under the office tree. In tones of amused sorrow, he said to nobody in particular, "You know, it's not true that what counts is the thought and not the gift. It just isn't true. My mother was pulling my leg on that one. I have collected so much gift-wrapped trash over the years from people who copped out and hurriedly bought a little plastic cheapie to give under the protective flag of good thoughts. I tell you, it is the gift that counts. Or rather, people who think good thoughts give good gifts. It ought to be a rule, the brass rule of gift exchange." And he stomped off toward a garbage can, carrying his little gift as if it were a dead roach, and dropped it in. Well, maybe so. It's a kind of harsh judgment and cuts a little close for comfort, but the spirit of the season has been clear for a long time. God, who, it is said, started all this, cared enough to send the very best on more than one occasion, and the wise men did not come bearing tacky knick-knacks. Even old Santa, when he's making his list, is checking it twice. And the angels came bringing good news, which was not about a half-price sale. To be honest, I do know what I want someone to give me for Christmas. I've known since I was 40 years old. Wind-up mechanical toys that make noises and go round and round and do funny things, no batteries. Toys that need me to help them out from time to time. The old-fashioned painted tin ones I had as a child. That's what I want. Nobody believes me. It's what I want, I tell you. Well, okay, that's close, but not quite exactly. It's delight and simplicity that I want. Foolishness and fantasy and noise, angels and miracles and wonder and innocence and magic. That's closer to what I want. It's harder to talk about, but, well, what I really, really down deep want from Christmas is just this. I want to be 5 years old again for an hour. I want to laugh a lot and cry a lot. I want to be picked up and rocked to sleep in someone's arms and then carried up to bed just one more time. I know what I really want for Christmas. I want my childhood back. I know it doesn't make sense, but since when is Christmas about sense? Christmas is about a child of long ago and far away, and Christmas is about the child of now, and you in me, waiting behind the door of our hearts for something wonderful to happen. A child who is impractical, unrealistic, simple-minded, and vulnerable to joy. A child who does not need or want or understand gifts of socks or potholders. People who think good thoughts give good gifts, period. The brass rule is true. I call this next essay Cuckoo Clock. I always wanted a cuckoo clock, a big Baroque German job with all kinds of carved foobahs and a little bird that leaps out once an hour and hollers an existential comment about life, cuckoo. So I got one. For my best friend, who also happens to be my wife and lives in the same house with me. See, the way this deal works out is that she usually doesn't really like what I give her for Christmas anyway, and I usually end up with it in the end, so I figure I might as well start out by giving her something I want in the first place, so when I get it back, I can be truly grateful. She gets the thought, which makes her very happy, and I get the gift. I know it's wicked, but it's realistic and practical. And don't get high-minded about this, as if you would never think of doing such a thing. The hell you say, I've been around, I know what people do, I know what I know. Anyway, I wanted an authentic antique cuckoo clock, but they cost a bundle. And this store I passed had new ones, overstocked, a special cheap price, hot deal. So I bought one. There were two messages written in very small print on the carton, which I missed reading. Made in South Korea was one, and Some Assembly Is Required was the other. The carton produced 5 plastic bags of miscellaneous parts, and an ersatz Bavarian Alpine goatherd hut marked genuine simulated wood. And to top it off, a plastic deer head that looked like Bambi's mother. I was delighted. I put it all together with no parts left over, thank you, and hung it on the wall. I pulled down the weights, pushed the pendulum, and stepped back. It ticked and tocked in a comforting kind of way. Never before had such an enterprise gone quite so well for me. The damn thing actually worked. The hour struck. The little door opened. The little bird did not come out. But from deep in its little hole came a raspy, muffled, "Ka-ka, ka-ka, ka-ka." 3 cuckoos? That's it? That's all? But the hands of the clock said noon. I peered deep into the innards of the Bavarian Alpine goatherd hut of simulated wood. There was the bird. Using an ice pick and a chopstick, I tried to pry the creature forth. It seemed loose. I reset the clock to 3. The clock ticked and tocked and then clanged. The door was flung open. No bird. Out of the darkness at the back of the hut came gook, but no ooh, not even ah. Applying the principle of, if it won't move, force it, I resorted to a rubber mallet and a coat hanger, followed by vigorous shaking. Reset the clock. Hour struck. Door open. Silence. Close inspection revealed a small corpse with a spring around its neck lying on its side. Not many people have murdered a cuckoo clock bird, but I had done it. I could see Christmas morning. Here, dear, a cuckoo clock for you. The bird is dead. And I did. I gave her the clock. And I told her the story, and she laughed. And she kept the clock, too, dead bird and all, for a while. Well, the clock and its bird are long gone from our house now. Christmas has come and gone many times as well, but the story gets told every year when we gather with friends in December. They laugh, and my wife looks at me and grins her grin, and I grin back. She reminds me that the real cuckoo bird in this story was not the critter inside the clock. I remember. And me? Well, I still don't have a cuckoo clock of my own, but I have kept something. It's the memory of the Christmas message written on the packing carton. It said, "Some assembly is required." To assemble the best that is within you and give it away. And to assemble with those you love to rekindle joy. Some assembly is required at Christmas. Cuckoo to you, old bird, and Merry Christmas, wherever you are. Now I'll add a parenthesis to that story. Years later, when I retired from the parish ministry, my congregation gave me a parting gift, a first-class cuckoo clock, big one. And every time the bird came out, I thought of them, a little bit cuckoo, but reliable. The clock, unfortunately, fell off the wall in an earthquake 2 years ago, smashed, repaired, but now somewhat unpredictable in the hours it keeps and the appearance of the bird. More like me now, I suppose. Cuckoo. The next midwinter essay is entitled Valentine Christmas Tree. First, a little background. I often spend the winter in the mountains of far southeastern Utah, San Juan County, Four Corners region. Not many people live around here, mostly Navajo Indians and Mormon farmers. The national forest is large and nearby, so it's still possible to keep the old tradition of taking the family out to cut down a tree in the woods just before Christmas. But times have changed here, too. The pockets of available fir and pine trees have diminished in size and number. The trees grow slowly here, not as fast as the population grows. But another thing that's grown is the population's awareness of how people affect the environment, even in this remote location. The number of trees available for seasonal cutting has been sharply reduced. The tension between nostalgia for the past and fear for the future exists even here. Many are shifting to having live or artificial trees. We understand why this is necessary, but we don't like it. It's depressing. Somehow, it just isn't Christmas without a real tree in the house. In late December, I drove a long way out into the backcountry to hike for an afternoon in the winter sunshine. The area is high desert, sagebrush and scrub, but with red sandstone formations and sheltered side canyons that still contain pine trees. These evergreens are old-growth remnants of the great forest which dominated this landscape in wetter eras. Hiking up a stream bed, I had what I thought was a hallucination. A fully decorated Christmas tree stood just ahead of me. And it was for real. A pine tree, about 12 feet high, gnarled and bent as it fought its way out of the rocks that had cradled its existence for, who knows, perhaps 200 years or more. Strings of popcorn and cranberries looped around its branches. Dried fruit and cookies and nuts hung from the branches like ornaments, and at the very top perched a silver star with a tiny angel at the center. It was the most beautiful Christmas tree I have ever seen. Who did this? Well, two sets of tracks told me something, one large and one small, an adult and a child. These somebodies had come all the way out here, carried all this stuff, and carefully decorated the tree with things that birds and small animals might eat. More than that, they had the imagination to think of doing this in the first place. They must have had a wonderful time thinking through the logistics and then actually coming out here and decorating the tree. And now they have a wonderful memory of one of the best Christmas trees ever. And what's more, the tree lives on. Later, now early February, I went back in the same direction looking for sunshine and solitude. I thought I'd check on the tree, but I had a hard time finding it because the same somebodies had come back and undecorated the tree. The fresh tracks in the muddy ground around the tree seemed to match those I had seen in the snow in December. All the evidence of the decorating had been removed, and the star angel was gone. How did they get it up there, and how did they get it down? A ladder? No. A child standing on a parent's shoulders. That would do it. I'm inspired. My tree quandary is solved. I've picked my pine and enlisted two small co-conspirators, and from now on, come December 21st, we'll decorate, and we'll go back to undecorate on February 14th, Valentine's Day. Imagine how the woods would look each December if more of us made such a pilgrimage in the dead of winter to see the evergreen trees and decorate them with care, and then went back to restore the woods to their natural beauty. What would our children think? As I said at the beginning, this is a Valentine's story. It's about loving something, not just oneself or one's family or one's neighbor. It's about loving life, about loving this silly old world, and seeing this world as our living room with a Christmas tree in it. Well, one year I didn't receive many Christmas cards. One fetid February afternoon, this troublemaking realization actually came to me out of the back room of my head. That is the source of useless information. Guess I needed some reason to feel really crummy, so there it was. But I didn't say anything about it. I can take it. I'm tough. I won't complain when my cheap friends don't even care enough to send me a stupid Christmas card. I can do without tacky love. Sure, right. Well, the following August, I was nesting in that same attic, trying to establish some order in the mess, and found stacked in with the holiday decorations a whole box of unopened greeting cards from the previous Christmas. I had tossed them into the box to open at leisure, and then I ran out of leisure in the shambles of the usual Christmas panic, so the cards got caught up in the bail it up and stuff it in the attic and we'll straighten it out next year syndrome. I hauled the box down, and on a hot summer day, middle of August, mind you, in my bathing suit, sitting in a lawn chair on my deck with sunglasses, a quart of iced tea, and a puzzled frame of mind, I began to open my Christmas cards. Just to help, I had put a tape of Christmas carols on the portable stereo and cranked up the volume. Merry Christmas. I opened the envelopes and set them out on the deck all around me, and here it all was. Angels, snow, wise men, candles and pine boughs, horses and sleighs, the holy family, elves, Santa, the works. Heavy messages about love and joy and peace and goodwill. And if that wasn't enough, there were all those handwritten messages of affection from my cheap friends who had, in fact, come through for the holidays. Well, I cried. Seldom have I felt so bad and so good at the same time, so wonderfully rotten, elegantly sad, and melancholy and nostalgic and all. Bathos, utter bathos. As fate always seems to have it, I was discovered in this condition by a neighbor who had been attracted to the scene by the sound of Christmas caroling in my backyard. She laughed. I showed her the cards. She got weepy. I got weepy. And we had this outrageous Christmas ordeal right there on my back deck in the middle of August, singing along with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir to the final mighty strains of, "Oh, Holy Night, fall on your knees, oh, hear the angel voices." What can I say? I guess wonder and awe and joy are always there in the attic of one's mind somewhere, and it doesn't take a lot to set it off. And much about Christmas is outrageous, whether it comes to you in December or late August. Take it when you can get it. Midwinter conversation, talking with a nice lady on the phone. She has a case of the midwinter spiritual rot and a terminal cold she's had since September the 1st.
"Well," rasped she, "you don't ever get depressed, do you?"
"Listen. I get lows it takes extension ladders to get out of."
"So, what do you do?" asked she. "I mean, what do you do?"
Nobody ever pinned me down quite like that before. They usually ask me what I think they should do. What do I do? My solace is not religion or yoga or rum or even deep sleep. It's Beethoven, as in Ludwig van. He's my ace in the hole. I put his 9th symphony on the stereo, pull the earphones down tight, and lie down on the floor, and the music comes on like the first day of creation. And I lie there and I think about old Mr. B. He knew a whole lot about depression and unhappiness. He moved around from place to place, trying to find the right place. His was a lousy love life, and he quarreled with his friends all the time. A rotten nephew worried him deeply, a nephew he really loved. Mr. B. wanted to be a virtuoso pianist. He wanted to sing well, too. But when still quite young, he began to lose his hearing, which is usually bad news for pianists and singers. And by 1818, when he was 48, he was stone-cold deaf. Which makes it all the more amazing that he finished his great 9th symphony 5 years later. He never really heard it. He just thought it. Imagine that. So I lie there with my earphones on, wondering if it ever could have felt to Beethoven like it sounds in my head. The crescendo rises, my sternum starts to vibrate, and by the time the final kettle drum drowns out all those big Fs, I'm on my feet, singing at the top of my lungs in gibberish German with the mighty choir and jumping up and down as the legendary Fuljamowski directs the final awesome moments of the end of the world and the coming of God and all his angels, hallelujah, hallelujah, woom, kaboom, bam, bah. Uplifted, exalted,
Excited, affirmed, and overwhelmed am I, man alive. Out of all that sorrow and trouble, out of all that frustration and disappointment, out of all that deep and permanent silence, came all that majesty, that outpouring of joy and exaltation. He defied his fate with jubilation. And me, I cannot resist all that truth and beauty. I just can't manage to continue sitting around in my winter ash heap, wringing my hands and feeling sorry for myself in the face of that music. Not only does it wipe out spiritual rot, it probably cures colds, too. "So what's all this noise about winter and rain and bills and taxes?" says I to me. "So who needs all this talk about failure and confusion and frustration? What's all this noise about life and people being no damned good? Get up, Fulgem, get on with it." In the midst of oatmeal days, I find within Beethoven's music an irresistible affirmation. In deep spiritual winter, I find inside myself the sun of summer. And someday, some incredible December night, when I am very rich, I am going to rent me a grand hall and a great choir and a mighty symphony orchestra and stand on the podium and conduct the ninth. And I will personally play the kettle drum part all the way through to the glorious end, while simultaneously singing along at the very top of my lungs, and in the awesome silence that follows, I will bless all the gods that be for Ludwig van Beethoven, for his ninth, for his light, Mela. I'll add a parenthesis to that. Yes, as a matter of magical fact, I did get to conduct that great piece of music, Beethoven's Ode to Joy, with the Minneapolis Chamber Orchestra. Crazy dreams can come true when the dreamer has a crazy fairy godmother or two in Minneapolis. And the experience, oh, was all I hoped for, and a good deal more. It's too long to tell you about here, but you can find my account of that improbable adventure in my book, Maybe, Maybe Not. I had the time of my life, man alive. Now, it's January. I should tell you from the beginning, this is a story that makes me weepy. I don't apologize. I loved the man whose story it is. A man I know keeps a bottle of vodka in his bathroom. Every morning, as he begins his shaving routine, he takes the bottle out of the medicine cabinet and puts it on the glass shelf just below the mirror. As he lathers his face, he considers himself in the mirror, and he considers the bottle of vodka. He uses an old-fashioned straight-edged razor, and as he shaves under his chin, he considers how deadly dangerous the blade is, but he never cuts himself. When he has finished shaving, he replaces his razor and soap and the bottle in the medicine cabinet and goes about his life. The man's morning shaving routine has become a sacred ritual which exorcises demons and binds him to life as surely as if he had gone to his knees in the bathroom in prayer. That bottle of vodka is half empty. There is a line drawn in indelible ink confirming the level and the date the line was drawn. The top was screwed down tight on the bottle on the morning of that date, January 17. The bottle has never been opened since. And there are little marks alongside the date, the kind used to indicate the passage of time, four straight lines with a slash across them to count five, plus four more equal nine. A slash will be made across those last four lines a few days from now, marking 10. 10 years ago, as he tilted the vodka bottle to his lips for the first of his frequent secret nips of the day, he saw in the mirror that the bathroom door behind him had opened a crack. The eyes of his only child met his. Those eyes were brimming with tears. Time stood still. Nothing was said.
The door softly closed, and the only eyes he had to look into were his own, reflected in the mirror, bloodshot and puffy. In a jaundiced face, veined and aged beyond his years, for the first time in a long time, he really considered his image before him. A stranger stared back, and he was appalled. He wished he were dead. But later that day he called a friend who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that night he went to the first of many AA meetings and stood up to say, "My name is Ed, and I'm an alcoholic." When he got home, he threw away all his hidden bottles of booze except one. As he screwed down the top on the bottle of vodka in the bathroom, he made a promise to himself, "Never again, so help me God, never." Now, this is a tough road to walk. It's never been easy. Many's the time he's locked the bathroom door behind him and considered taking just one more small drink and then replacing the missed alcohol with water to restore the level. And he's even looked at the razor as a solution to more than the problem of needing a shave. But the memory of the face of his child at the door haunts him. And so he has prevailed. Keeping faith with his God, his friends, his wife, himself, and that child. Oh, how I wish I could be there in the bathroom with him on January the 17th, along with a brass band and gifts and family and friends. Hooray, thank God! But anniversary occasions like these are usually solitary events, celebrated alone in the chapel of one soul. It may be enough for my friend to draw that line marking 10 years, and then look up and face the man in the mirror with respect. You know, the good news is that there will be many such secret celebrations this month of January. Many vows and resolutions are made in January. For all of us who don't live up to our best intentions, there are those who succeed. Their names will not be in the newspaper. No certificates, formal receptions, or parties will mark their success, but their numbers are greater than you may think. And they might be surprised at how many of the rest of us know about what they have done. The power of hope is confirmed by their triumph. To all of those who have kept their promise to themselves, who have managed to defeat destructive demons of many kinds, large and small, let it be known that the rest of us celebrate you. We think of you as heroes. Because of you, we take heart for our own struggles. Happy anniversary from all of us. Press on. So ends my midwinter thinking on a happy note. Now I will share some thoughts about a common topic, high school reunions. Despite swearing I would never do it, I went to the 30-year reunion of my high school class deep in the heart of Texas. I had not seen those so-called kids since the night I graduated, and one quick glance confirmed my worst expectations. Bald heads, gray hair, double chins, wrinkles, fat, liver marks, funny looking, not funny. Old. We're old now, I thought, so soon, and it's all downhill from here. Decay, rot, disease, an early grave. I felt tired. I began to walk slower with a noticeable limp. I began to think about my will and make mental notes for my funeral. This malaise lasted all of 30 seconds. It was wiped out by the bright memory of two men I had met earlier in the summer at a truck stop in Burns, Oregon. Mr. Fred Easter, 68, and his good friend, Mr. Leroy Hill, 62. They were bicycling from Pismo Beach, California, to see the rodeo in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. They had been sitting on a bench by the beach, reading in the newspaper about the rodeo, and one of them said, "Let's go." So they got up and went. And here they were in Burns in flashy riding suits, with high-tech bikes and all, and When I asked Mr. Easter how come, he laughed. Why, just for the hell of it, son, just for the bloody hell of it, because we can. 5,800 miles later, by way of Colorado and the Grand Canyon, they expected to arrive home in October. Unless, of course, other interesting things turned up along the way. They were not in a race. I walked away from that encounter tall and straight and handsome and young, making new lists of all the things I would do and all the places I would go and all the things I would be in all the years ahead of me. Retire? Never. Die? Never. As I write now, it's almost 20 years later. I've not forgotten Mr. Fred Easter and Mr. Leroy Hill, in their 80s now, still moving on, I hope. They would approve of what I've done in these 20 years. Lots. Next year, 2004, my 50th high school reunion looms as a faint, fuzzy marker in the onrushing future. Will I go? Probably not. Where will I be? Well, I've never been to that rodeo in Calgary. Why the hell not? Here's a story about the San Diego Zoo. San Diego has a zoo and a wild animal park, and the combination is the finest in the world, some say. Being a serious zoo fan, I recently spent a day there. Zoos are great for adults. They take your mind off reality for a while. For example, did you ever look real close at a giraffe? A giraffe is unreal. If there is a heaven, and I go there, don't bet heavy on either of those, but if, then I'm going to ask about giraffes. Just what was on God's mind the day when he invented giraffes? I'd like to know. A little girl standing beside me at the zoo asked her mommy the question I had. What's it for, mommy? Mommy didn't know. Does the giraffe know what he's for, or care, or even think about his place and things? I don't know. A giraffe has a black tongue, 27 inches long, and no vocal cords. Did you know that? A giraffe has nothing to say. He just goes on giraffing. Beside the giraffe, I saw a wombat, a duck-billed platypus, and an orangutan. Unreal, all of them. The orangutan looked just like my Uncle Woody. Uncle Woody was pretty unreal, too. He belonged in a zoo, that's what his wife said. And that makes me wonder what it would be like if samples of people were also in zoos. I was thinking about that last notion while watching the lions, a gentleman lion and 6 lady lions. Looks like a real nice life being in a zoo. The lions are so prolific that the zoo has had to place IUDs in each of the lionesses. So all the lions do is eat and sleep and scratch fleas and have sex without consequences. The zoo provides food, lodging, medical care, old age security, and funeral expenses. Such a deal. We humans make a big thing about our being the only thinking, reflective critter and make proclamations like the unexamined life is not worth living. But I look at the deal the giraffes and the lions and the wombats and the duckbill what's-it-called, and I think I could go for the unexamined life. If the zoo ever needs me, I'd give it a try. I certainly qualify as a one-of-a-kind endangered species, and examining my life sure gets to be a drag sometimes. Imagine you and your kids passing by a large, comfy cage, all littered with cigar butts, cognac bottles, and T-bone steak bones, and there, snoozing in the sun, is old Fulgham, with 6 beautiful ladies piled up around him, and your kid points and says, "What's it for?" And I'd yawn and open one eye and say, "Who cares?" Like I say, zoos tend to take your mind off reality. The lion and the giraffe and the wombat and the rest do what they do and are what they are, and somehow manage to make it there in the cage, living the unexamined life. But to be human is to know and care and ask, to keep rattling the bars of the cage of existence, hollering, "What's it for? What's it for?" at the stones and stars, and making prisons and palaces out of the echoing answers. That's what we do, and that's what we are. A zoo is a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't really want to live there. The next six stories belong in a section all by themselves. They are about a neighbor, the guy next door. When I think of all the places I have lived, what I remember most about why I liked living there was not the house itself. It was the neighbors, the great ones. Most of us, if we're lucky, have had a good neighbor in our lives. Or else, we are that person to someone else. We watch each other, and for good or ill, learn from one another. The people next door play a substantial role in our lives, and yet we seldom choose them. I once went house hunting with a friend who was a Native American. She was interested in the usual aspects of real estate, the location, the condition of the house, the price, and so on, but her two priorities were the neighbors and the trees. She looked carefully for a house with big, beautiful trees in the yard, and before she got serious about buying, she went to meet and get acquainted with the neighbors. She said a house could be remodeled, even torn down and rebuilt, but fine trees take a long time, and good neighbors make a huge difference in the quality of life, and I agree. As you will hear in the stories that follow, I once had the great good fortune of having a great neighbor. For the purpose of a good story, I have exaggerated a little, but not much, believe me. The facts are true, and the guy next door was for real. For several years, I lived on a steep hillside in a decrepit summer cottage that had what a real estate agent called charm, which meant it was a shack with a view. In keeping with the spirit of the house, I let the yard go natural, letting what wanted to be there, and take care of itself without any help from me. I remember announcing from the front porch to all living things in the yard, "You're all on your own. Good luck." Up the hill above me lived Mr. Washington, in a sleek ranch-style and shingle dwelling with a yard kept like a combination golf course and arboretum. It was his pride and joy. An older man, insurance agent, and a mighty cooking champion when it came to barbecued ribs and brisket. Mr. Washington was also black, and I am not. I'm more putty-colored, actually. It was the late 60s, and I was an agitated activist into civil rights, peace, being obsessively liberal about anything you cared to mention. Mr. Washington was into, well, I'll use his exact words. "Well, Jim, you are a downwardly mobile liberal honky, and I'm an upwardly mobile nigger, and don't you forget it." And then he'd laugh and laugh. He looked down on me in more ways than one, and I looked up to him in more ways than one. An odd twist of 60s sociology. I admit it made me nervous when he used the N-word, and I'm even uncomfortable reading it today. I didn't mind honky. It had a benevolent charm when he said it, but that other word, well, but that's what he called himself, and he always laughed when he said it. Mr. Washington looked down from his porch onto my ratty residence with amused and tolerant contempt. He said he put up with me because I could cook better chili than he could, and I had the best collection of power tools in the neighborhood and was glad to loan them to him. Sometimes we played poker, and we both shared a fondness for fine cigars and the fact of wives who did not share that fondness. We walked in the same marches of those times, the ones about racial justice and peace, and we liked the same music, jazz, once spending most of an evening comparing the solos of John Coltrane and Johnny Hodges. And always, always there was his laughter, no matter how grim or serious the world might get. He saw the comic strip we are all in. He had the best laugh I have ever heard. In an uncommon way, we provided a reference point for one another as we sorted out our daily lives, as you will see. He's dead now, and I really miss him. I think about him when I cook barbecue using his recipe for sauce. Mine's not as good as his. The secret ingredient was his laughter while he cooked. Mr. Washington was a hardcore lawn freak, as I've suggested, and his yard and my yard blended together in an ambiguous fashion.